is really a story about kind of music consciousness for a lot of people like me of my generation. It's like, this is not the only blues band around. Although I'll argue that at this period in the early 70s, this was one of the last true remaining scenes with honest juke joints and chitlin circuit clubs, and I got to see that. It wasn't something I just read about. But at this time, early 70s, the history is for most Anglos, white kids that were smitten with music, their entree of the blues was records.
Writer, broadcaster, and blues fan Jonick Batoski returns to the Plutopia podcast discussing his new book, The Ballad of Robert Ely and His Five Careless Lovers. Jonick talks about his self-published book and his introduction to the blues in Fort Worth's early 70s club scene.
Hey, welcome everybody to the Plutopia podcast. You can find us at plutopia.io on the web and wherever fine podcasts are distributed. You can usually find us there. Apple, Spotify, all those places. Our guest today is Jonick Batoski, who's been writing about Texas and Texans for like 40 years or more. And he's written a lot about Texas music and hosts the weekly Texas Music Hour of Power on Saturday nights. We're going to be talking about his latest book, The Ballad of Robert Ely and His Five Careless Lovers, which is an oral history of Fort Worth blues in the 70s. So, Jonick, welcome back.
John, good to be back. And good to be back among all the Plutopians.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we're creating an empire here, just a little bit at a time. We have a radio show now on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 4, by the way. You're welcome to
hear this. Where?
So what made you decide to put this book together, and kind of what was your process for doing it?
About this time last year, I was talking to some old friends of mine from Fort Worth, which is where I grew up. And through those friends, I heard that another friend, Freddie Cisneros, who lives in Prescott, Arizona now, had a cardiac incident. And I thought, shit, my friend Freddie almost split. And Freddie was, I met Freddie when he was a musician, and I was just kind of coming of age, really getting into music and more than just a casual listener or fan, but really getting into it. And Freddie was a guitarist in this band, Robert Ely and the Five Careless Lovers, that I saw in Fort Worth back in 1971, 72, while I was working as a DJ at a radio station there and running a record shop in Fort Worth. I had all kinds of ideas going on. And this was the live band that kind of changed the way I looked at music. When Freddie had his heart attack, I already knew another careless lover in Fort Worth, Sumter Bruton III, who's kind of the ringleader of all this, was in poor health and was not doing well, not leaving the house, not very communicative. So I set it upon myself to go visit Sumter back in January, not really knowing what, but it's just like Sumter has so many good stories. I wanted to capture them before he leaves the building. And I did. And we had about 3 hours worth of rambling conversation. And out of that, I got the idea I'd like to go do an oral history. I've got some tape on Sumter. So go to the other three surviving members of this band and get the story. The front man, Robert Ely, who is kind of the ghost centerpiece of this book, passed away in the early 2000s. And 4 years later, he was followed by the organ player, good rockin' Ralph Owens. the Reverend Good Rockin' Ralph Owens, I might add, because he finally went back to the church and found his way. So really the two black mentors for these white kids, these four white kids, they were gone. And I can't get their story. I mean, it's really hard. So get what I could through these four guys that I know, Freddie Cisneros, Sumter Bruton, Mike Buck, who is in Austin as I am. Mike is an accomplished musician, has drummed with many bands, including the Leroy Brothers, even the Exiles, and going back to the Fabulous Thunderbirds. And Mike, when we met in Fort Worth at this period of time, it was the one that kind of drew me in and invited me to these juke joints to go see his band play. And, you know, I love music, and I went to concerts. And I actually, you know, my first concert was when I was 4 years old. I got my mom to take me to go see Homer and Jethro. They were opening up for Tommy Sands. And that was, you know, at Will Rogers Auditorium. I was very conventional as far as how I consume music. Even in high school, we had dances and we'd go see concerts. But, you know, when right in your own neighborhood, you know, within 2 miles of where you live, you're shown on the bad side of town a juke joint and offered entree, and offered entree into several of them through this band. This got to be, this was transformational for me, and it really opened my eyes. At the time, I was at a FM progressive rock music station, free form format, could play anything I wanted, and they had a great jazz catalog, which is one thing that kind of separated KFAD from most other free form FMs. But, you know, in other respects, it was conventional. Most of the blues music that was played on this station came from Britain. You know, it was Led Zeppelin. It was the Yardbirds. It was Pretty Things. I mean, that's what people knew. And maybe, you know, B.B. King might have been snuck on there. And I think at that time, Freddie King was beginning to cross over. But, you know, that was one world. And then all of a sudden, you go into these juke joints to hear this crazy-ass band. And you realize, I mean, the stage is not just that little riser area off in the corner. It's like the stage is the whole joint once you walk in. And you walk into this scene where there are stories being told on many levels. And it's not just performance. So, you know, for me, who has spent a lot of his adult life writing about music in a way that I like to think informs and has always been kind of motivated by, where does this come from and how does it get to be so cool, and, you know, what's the root of all this? I'd rather hear Mexicans or blacks play Chuck Berry than I'd rather hear Chuck Berry play it. I'd rather hear their interpretation. Yeah, that's growing up in Texas, and, you know, in Fort Worth, like most other Texas cities, you grew up around, definitely there was a larger black community than there was a brown community. And Freddie was one of my friends also that was this entree. And Freddie was an interesting character in that he is Mexican-American, but he grew up, you know, playing rock and roll, listening to his sister's records. And this is really a story about kind of music consciousness for a lot of people like me of my generation. It's like, this is not the only blues band around. Although I'll argue that at this period in the early 70s, this was one of the last true remaining scenes with honest juke joints and Chitlin' Circuit clubs. And I got to see that. It wasn't something I just read about. But at this time, early 70s, the history is for most Anglos, white kids that were smitten with music, their entree of the blues was records. And I learned this later, where, you know, actually a year or two later, working the Electric Fetus in Minneapolis and meeting Dave Ray of Kerner Ray and Glover, Tony Tony Glover, Spider John Kerner. And these guys were like so honest and real. But what I learned really quick, and especially watching Dave perform, is they learned all this shit listening to records. It was not direct transmission. And what I saw at Mabel's Eat Shop, TJ's Chicken in the Basket, JD's Club, and certainly the new Bluebird Nightclub, Tax Funhouse, was direct transmission. You really saw this is like, here's the music as it was being made for the audience it was intended to. There was no distance. So, you know, this was a period of time when, you know, people are getting into where music comes from. It wasn't just enough to, and, you know, if you were curious enough, you'd learn real quick about, you know, Led Zeppelin, who they were thieving from, and, you know, and it basically led you back to where you were. And that's what I started realizing. It took me a while, even after the fact, when I was experiencing this, it's like, oh, these guys, Robert and his main man, guitar man, originally was Robert Ely, came from Dallas, where he had a duo with UP Wilson. UP played guitar, Robert played drums. I mean, talk about primitive. And the thing is, they were kind of, Robert had moved from Texarkana. He grew up in Texarkana as a kid, but he moved to Dallas. He was going to get involved with gospel music. But he got turned around by Frankie Lee Sims and Little Son Jackson, Mercy Baby, who, these are people that are very obscure blues players in the great cosmos. But if you get into blues, I mean, these are some of the greatest guitar stylists ever, anywhere. You know, you can argue about Robert Johnson and the Delta Blues and all this. The shit that was coming out of Dallas, and not just Dallas, but also Fort Worth and all over Texas, very different sound, very wide open. But, you know, that's T-Bone Walker country. It's Charlie Christian country. That's where the electric guitar was invented. So Robert was exposed to this in the 50s. And he went secular. He got a good job. He was a delivery driver. You know, he made money, but he never gave up what he did. So when he's in Fort Worth and supposedly settled down, this is where he kind of comes upon first Sumter Bruton, but also these other guys. He's always playing around, but these guys kind of changed the game a little bit and took it to another level, to the point he was recorded. And he was recorded not just by two guys, but Sumter's brother, Stephen Bruton, the guitarist that played with Kris Kristofferson, Bonnie Raitt. Bob Dylan was a performer and producer in his own right. That's his first production. And he's doing it alongside his friend, Terry Burnett, who becomes known on that album. He's producer T-Bone Burnett. And that's the very first production T-Bone Burnett does. As far as an album, putting an album together. So this is like, and they do it in a way that is, it tries to capture, it's a field recording like the Lomaxes did in the 30s, where you really try to capture the sounds of the audience and all that. And there have actually been other recordings done on Robert Ely and Sumter and Good Rockin' Ralph. A guy named Mike Price did a similar recording about a year or two earlier at a juke joint out in Rendon called Johnny B's, which is just, you know, you listen to the dialogue of the audience, and that's part of the show. And it's just like, the music is primitive as all get out. I mean, this is not slick. It's nothing's uptown about it, but it's just like, this is the good music that turned my head around, and I wanted to pay him back. So my COVID project was doing these interviews. My last ones were with Mike Buck, Jackie Newhouse, and Freddie Cisneros in Fort Worth in early March. They got together and played. They did a gig, and I interviewed them at Record Town. I'd interviewed them on the phone as well. So I thought I was going to sell an article to a magazine. They're going to chop it up. But it was long enough, and COVID does things to you. I'm sitting at a place in time. It's like, you know, am I going to try to spin my wheels trying to sell it to someone or some obscure blues magazine. It's like, and I contacted my friend Nancy McMillan. I started working with Nancy McMillan in 1975 when I first started working at Texas Monthly doing stories for him. And Nancy was there in the art department. She was there all the way through. She's retired. And I said, Nancy, you know anything about doing books? She said, yeah, I do private books all the time. So for about 2.5 months, I worked with Nancy. Once I had Jay Brakefield, a Texas blues scholar who's now in Clarksville, Mississippi. He helped transcribe these tapes back in the spring. Nancy, I spent 2 months with Nancy, who designed the book. And I mean, design is so important because, you know, it's posters and stuff. I'm a real nut about the posters, which these are all kind of from Lone Star Printing, but Freddie Cisneros designed the posters. And he's a student of that hard cardboard poster art. I don't know how you describe it, but it's just, it's such beautiful stuff. So Nancy designed it. And so what was like, hey, I want to interview Sumter back in January because he's dying and I want to get some stories from him, turned into a book in September, self-published. And actually I went through Blurb Press, but my publishing company is Horn and Wellesley Publishers. And Horn and Wellesley is the intersection where the new Bluebird Nightclub is located and where Mabel's Eat Shop was across the street.
When I was reading the book, it impressed me that it was edited almost like a really good radio documentary. Have you considered an audio version of what you gathered?
Those are two questions. And the first one is thank you, Scoop, because what I've learned with oral histories is you get the raw stuff down, but it's all in the edit. So, you know, the person thinking, well, oral history is great because it's my voice. It's all in the edit. And that was kind of key because there was a whole lot of rambling. Jay Brakefield, who did the transcript, decided everything was, instead of ing, was in apostrophe. Drove me nuts. I had to correct things. I'm correcting my editors. Which is a nice way of explaining why it's not an audiobook. I don't know how the hell you edit it. And I swear, these are the conditions. What I interviewed were four old men talking about something that happened 50 years ago. And they've got memories, but they're also old men. Sumter is practically unintelligible. And it's just, you know, it's just his accent, which is not improved if he's been imbibing. And so Jay and I really had kind of, we had back and forth about deciphering statements. So could I share that audiobook? No, I went in thinking that, and that was probably my mistake, is if I was running with you, you're a guy that carries equipment and microphones and things like that. I'm down and dirty, and it's like, just, you know, give it to me so I can transcribe it. And I hate transcribing, by the way. One of the worst things that I have to do. And in fact, I paid Jay to do a lot of transcribing. But I ended up doing it because we couldn't understand what the fuck was being said. It would have to be under different circumstances. I think these guys' stories are great, and I would love to do that. But in Sumter's case, you got to go to his house. And you got to go at a certain time of the afternoon when he's awake and lucid. And when you do, they're the greatest stories in the world. I couldn't do an audio book of it, even though audio is the storytelling, the verbal storytelling is what drove this. And what I'd really love to do is, get more or have Robert speaking. A disc jockey, Don O, who runs the blues show and has been doing the blues show since the 1980s on KNON in Dallas, Left of the Dial. I mean, he's kind of the blues voice of Dallas-Fort Worth area. And he sent me some recordings of Robert that were made in the 80s. He got to know him later in the game. I got to see all this come together. And that was my whole interest. It's like the first 2 years of the Careless Lovers was it. I didn't want to know about, there was a lot that followed. And it began with my brother-in-law, Johnny Reno. And so I got him in there and kind of introducing where he comes in and where a couple other sax players come in. And that begins this long progression of young players to get educated. And that goes on all the way to the 1990s. And, you know, maybe this happened in other cities. I don't know. But when I think of what was profound is I think about one is, yeah, they also had records. And Sumter Bruton and Stephen Bruton's parents ran the coolest record shop in Fort Worth, which still exists, Record Town. So they got their education through records before they discovered what was in their own backyard. And everybody else did. So you've got some elements there that are unique in the fact that Record Town is where T-Bone Burnett, who's really one of the great American record producers of the 20th and 21st century, got his musical education, and he says as much. He said so in his biography. And, you know, like my brother-in-law, Johnny Reno, he went on to play with Stevie Vaughan and Chris Isaac. Jackie Newhouse went on to play with Stevie Vaughan, was in the band Double Trouble before Tommy Shannon replaced him. Mike Buck went on to found the Thunderbirds and the Leroy Brothers. And you know, it's just that part and the fact that there was this art crowd that came and dug them through the Brutons, a society crowd got into them. It's just, that's what's kind of separates it. I think this was a, there are many scenes, but I'll put it this way. Norton Records, which is a reissue label that does like rock and roll punk music, mainly from the 50s and 60s up in New York. Miriam Lena and Billy Miller, who's deceased now, but Miriam and Billy did a three-record set of the Fort Worth teen scene in 1967 to 1970 based on singles coming out of Fort Worth. And they put out a three-album set that this guy, Larry Harrison, kind of compiled in Fort Worth. And basically, these people sitting in New York thought, this is the quintessential rock and roll scene. These records define how America reacted to, responded to rock and roll and, you know, the coming of the Beatles and all this. And so you think, oh, well, Fort Worth. But hey, Fort Worth's where Western Swing was invented, where Bob Wills, you know, started the Texas Playboys, but more important, Bob Wills and Milton Brown collaborating. Milton Brown was really the story about Western Swing. But you've got Western Swing, and you've got this great jazz and rhythm and blues tradition that I am Terrell High School, the Marching Panther band at one time had Ornette Coleman and Curtis Owsley, King Curtis, playing in their marching band along with Ronald Shannon Jackson. And it was a heavy, oh, and C.L. Dupree, Cornell Dupree, who is with King Curtis. And, you know, and there's pictures when King Curtis is doing playing at the Skyliner in the 60s with Cornell. And, you know, in that band, Jimi Hendrix played for a while on his way to becoming Jimi Hendrix. That was one of his stops for like half a year. And so, you know, this is Fort Worth. And the best part about all this is the real cool music that's come out of Fort Worth's always been under the rug, less recognized. Maybe it's that Dallas syndrome, Second City syndrome, but there's a lot of music. And it's where Willie Nelson really came of age. When I look at Willie Nelson's development and Willie Nelson and Epic Life, that biography, I went back because I wanted, you know, I'd heard Willie's telling, but I wanted to figure out where did he come of age? Where did he become Willie? And Fort Worth was where it happened. So, and you're thinking all this stuff's going on. Similarly, I mean, it's black and white. It's hillbilly. It's honky tonk. And it's lowdown. I mean, they've got a really good juke scene. So I got to get at the tail end of that. And this band, Robert E. Lee and his Five Carol Slivers, were the window that opened it up to me.
Well, I kind of want to ask about that juke scene, all these white kids coming down there to the black clubs, the juke joints. Was that like culture shock for everybody? Where was it a welcome environment back then?
It's reverse engineering, and I guess it culminates with the Bluebird, which was truly a salt and pepper scene, to the point that Mike Buck says after he left, there were some complaints about all the white kids coming down. And I actually, that has happened in many black scenes in the South. The Chitlin Circuits would always, a handful of white folks, if they were cool, could show up, and they were welcomed and tolerated without being hassled. And that was, for me, going down to TJ's Chicken in the Basket or next door, that scene in the Bottoms on the east side of Fort Worth, or up by Tax Funhouse, which was right by the projects downtown. Those were rough places. And, you know, it was kind of like you go in and you better make sure you have an escort, or, you know, or you knew the club owner knew you. And Mabel's Eat Shop was like that. And that's where the whites started showing up in numbers, to where it's like, half the house was, you know, of 40 people, half of them were white folks. And when it moved over to the Bluebird, there were probably sometimes when it would become as many, you know, as much as 3/4 of the crowd was white. But there was always kind of a running joke that whenever it got too white, someone would get rolled or robbed in the parking lot, and it'd kind of keep the crowds down, and, you know, it would shift the balance. But, you know, the ownership... Well, actually, and this is, you learn things. This is the segregated South. That building where the Bluebird is still was owned by, you know, a Jewish developer on the West Side. You know, it was a business proposition. He'd always owned it. So, you know, it was managed, run by African Americans, and that was historic. And the Bluebird, the building's still there, and there's talk about it might be reopened. I don't know what kind of scene you could have there, but it had such a great history. And I was so glad that when I got after really getting hooked on what it was. And, you know, this is the same time when I'm in Austin, or coming down to Austin. I go back to Fort Worth and go to the Bluebird. And, you know, sometimes I go over to the east side of Austin at Marie's Tea Room Number 2. Keith Ferguson and Bill Campbell took me over there. And that was kind of like, okay, on Weberville Road, or Ernie's Chicken Shack. Those were kind of like lingering jukes. But, you know, it wasn't a full-on vibe like I was getting in Fort Worth. So this was still blowing and going, and it was a scene. Stevie Vaughn goes up, you know, comes up to play. The Room Full of Blues band from Rhode Island come to sit in. So, you know, it becomes known and celebrated, and all that's cool, but it's no longer the Five Careless Lovers. It's the Careless Lovers. It's all these other bands that happen. So I want to capture this period of about 2 years. And the deal is, it's the best part of the story is always, how did you start this? How did it happen? Everybody's new, everybody's raw, and most people's memories are really sharp about that very first part. As it progresses, you know, things get fuzzy here and there.
So in your case, you had your own record store, right? And is that how you met Mike Buck? He was...
Yeah, he walked in up the street.
Yeah, and he's the one who turns you on to this scene?
Yeah, he comes and talks records, but, you know, it's real clear he's into cool records. not like the albums we're selling, the rock albums we're selling.
He had a bunch of 45s, right?
Yeah, and he would collect and start. He made me mixtapes early on, so it was not just Fort Worth and Dallas, but he educated me like a lot of Texas, a lot of swamp pop stuff. He was in many respects my mentor as far as cool. I'm, you know, many times I went over to his house just to listen to records, but it was more like getting to see where this band that he played in and the context that they were working in, that was always fun because, you know, I knew him. I knew these guys in the band. They were friends of mine. So no matter where they were, I could go hang out and hear them play. And that was always a cool thing. And I'm finding out people that came along 15, 20 years after I did that had very similar experiences with Robert and in the various ensembles he fronted. But, you know, he was that kind of a guy that was a mentor. But it was in a real scene. I was thinking another thing about Minneapolis, they had kind of a guy like Robert, Mojo Buford, who had played with Muddy Waters for a little while. And that was, you know, street cred. But you couldn't go hear Mojo Buford in his element. You can remember the Scholar Coffee House or, you know, regular joints, but you didn't hear him in his element. Robert Ely, you could hear him in white joints, but you also could go hear him at Johnny B's down in Rendon or my friend Jamie Alexander, who was a disc jockey at the same radio station I was, recalled to me after getting the book. He said, "Oh yeah, I remember Mike told us about this Sunday matinee we went to down at this place on Rosedale." And he said, and it was one of those where the only people, when we walk in, the place kind of all the eyes turned towards us. And we kind of sat there and we were kind of a little bit scared while we're watching with it. But everyone was nice to us and we had a good time and, you know, we went. But that was kind of his recollection of what did we walk into. But I've been doing that ever since. And maybe that club empowered me. But, you know, as I do stories, I remember doing this in clubs on Zarzamora and in San Antonio on the west side. And, you know, being the only gabacho in the joint. And when I walk in, you know, I'm not from the neighborhood. It's like everybody wants to know what the deal is. But I learned how to go, you know, you go figure out who's running the bar, let them know, you know, intentions or whatever. You know, you're there to have a good time. You're not a narc. You're not here to bust anyone. And things roll just fine. And so I've gotten to have some wonderful touristic experiences or anthropological experiences. And I credit my connections to the Careless Lovers to embolden me to do that.
You seem to have a lot of reverence for the institution, the record shop, the record store. And I know a lot of music people have the same thing. I know that's where I got my inspiration to be involved in music. What is it about the record shop, the record store?
Yeah, well, it's a source of information for one, if you know who to ask. And it's a community center, or it can be. I think we talk about the record shop today, maybe we have to explain a little bit more how much it was before a lot of the communication tools we have. It was the place you went to go hear the latest records. It was either that or the radio or your friend's house. But you would go to do it. And you know, there was Roland's was on the west side of Fort Worth. So that was closer for me. I remember riding my bike like 4 miles longer than I'd ever ridden before to go get a copy of Like a Rolling Stone by this Bob Dylan when I heard this 45 on the radio. So, you know, I was all head up for that. But, you know, the really cool store, as I look back, is Record Town in Fort Worth. Because I knew the older Sumter and Kathleen, the parents that ran the store, as well as, you know, Stephen went to school with me. He's a couple grades ahead. I knew Sumter from all around. I mean, they were just people that were nice to hang with. But I also remember you'd walk in there, and if you had a question, you'd get an answer. And then you'd get more than you'd ask for. So Sumter turned me on to Gory Carter, who, you know, is the father of, he did the first rock and roll record from Houston. Not Ike Turner and not the Delta Kings or Jackie Breston. This predated it by 2 years. And Sumter was all over Gory Carter, including his whistling song, which no one else played. And so that's a continuum that I came of age, that I think a lot of my friends, the Brutons, T-Bone Burnett, that continued to where Sumter left the counter 2 years ago, but maybe 5-7 years ago, there was a kid that would come in that they kept pulling down a guitar hanging on the ceiling for to let him play along to stuff, and Sumter would turn him on to stuff, and it was before he became famous as Leon Bridges. So there's a continuum that goes on here. And, you know, that's where, and I just know, like, with Sumter going over to his house, and he had this picture of these five black people around a table. And it looks like in a restaurant or nightclub, and it's on Central Avenue in Los Angeles. And these are the five Texas principals who basically salted the scene behind the scenes, not just the musicians, which there were so many Texans that made the trip out, like T-Bone Walker and Amos Milburn. But these were actually the behind-the-scenes players, the gangsters and the players that kind of ran a lot of the club scene in Central Avenue. And they were all Texans. And some people, yeah, this guy's from Houston, this guy's from Fort Worth. And, you know, just to see that, I want more stories like that. I just probably should go up there and have the recorder on and hang around, but that's hard to do.
Well, how does Texas blues differ from blues from other regions?
Texas, you need to think of it in geographical terms and also in the diaspora terms, African-American diaspora. This was where the South ended. And what's beyond here is wide open. And, you know, when slaves escaped, everybody talks about them going north. Around here, they went south. So all those things figure in. there's kind of a thread of blues men who've done recordings that I've collected along the way, including Frankie Lee Sims, where they do their Mexico song. And Robert Ely did his own Mexico song called Tica, in which it's complete, you know, it is not literate Spanish by any stretch of the imagination. And nor is the recording Frankie Lee Sims did 30 years earlier. But he goes into Spanish. That's a Texas thing. The main quality, I think, is wide open and electric guitar. But you have to augment the saxophone because there's such a rich sax history, filtering from New Orleans to Houston to San Antonio. And then there's the North Texas sax players that tie into the territory bands up in Oklahoma, up to, all the way to Kansas City. You know, I mean, the ringleader of Texas tenors is Buster Smith, who is from Dallas. David Fathead Newman is kind of that lineage there. And then Houston, Arnett Cobb, Illinois Jacquette. God, I mean, you know, King Curtis in Fort Worth. Where do you want to start? Where do you want to end? And in fact, that is kind of cool. When I finally did see Ornette Coleman for the first time, which was sometime in the 90s, was at Carnegie Hall. I weaseled a ticket. He was playing there. And it was pretty crazy. And Charlie Hayden was with him and opened up. And, you know, it was pretty wild stuff. It's not easy to follow. It's very intellectual. And, you know, like Shapes of Jazz to Come, which he was his recording from the 1950s. I can kind of understand that now, 70 years later. But the one thing that I picked up when I heard Ornette play live was that tone. And that was the same tone that I heard all the way through Fort Worth. And I mean, and the various sax players that Robert Ely had. So in the 70s, like 77, 78, I'm visiting, I'm working at the American Statesman. And I covered a show at the Armadillo, Old and New Dreams. And I didn't really know much about Old and New Dreams. But I did my 5-minute education. Oh, this was Ornette Coleman's band. And, you know, these were all the original players. I mean, this is pretty cool. And, you know, I recognized the names more, you know. At the end of the show, I sought out Dewey Redmond because I knew he was from Fort Worth. And I asked him, I said, do you ever remember a place on the west side of Fort Worth called the Bluebird? And he kind of like thought about it. He said, I think I saw Ornette walk the bar there. And my brother-in-law has walked the bar there. Many people have walked the bar there when during the iteration I got to see the Bluebird, but to know that joint goes back to the 40s and 50s. And Sumter had kind of filled in blanks. He said that was a jazz club and it kind of fallen into disuse when we came along and kind of revived it. So Texas music is guitar because of T-Bone and because of Charlie Christian, because of everybody else that's followed all the way through to the Vaughns and beyond, and to Gary Clark. I mean, there is a continuum, and it's always wild, it's twangy, it's out front. Lightnin' Hopkins, when he electrified. But you got to always factor in the horns. It, most of all, the sound is wide open. And it's, you know, the return of wide open spaces. That was the great Fathead Newman James Clay album collaboration. So, you know, all that is kind of tied into this small little book here that I did. And it makes me want to go chase some more. But it also has empowered me with the idea that, you know, you want to tell a story? I know how to make a book. You know, I may have to, you may have to go rob a few banks or something to get a little bit of money, but it's not that much. And we can do it quicker than a real publisher can. And it can look just as good. So that was kind of the coda on the back. We're finding pictures all the way through this. But that's Sumter Bruton, Stephen Bruton, his brother, late brother, and their dad, the elder Sumter, who was a jazz drummer from Philadelphia, who played in a band with 14 blacks, and he's the only white guy. So I guess the kids learned well.
Why is it that a lot of blues purists have a low opinion of white blues? Why do you think that happens?
I don't know. You know, this band here is kind of it's the authenticity, and it's like the direct transmission, I guess. Going through this, you know, there was a continuum. A lot of bands started up after the Careless Lovers did in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, mainly white blues bands. And a lot of them were, you know, guys that would go play with Robert for a while and then start their own band. And, you know, you get into this, if you try to do it too authentically, you're doing blackface. And, you know, think about that. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, Joe Bonamassa, come on. I mean, all the, you know, even a Kenny Wayne Shepherd, bless his heart. He can play like Stevie did, and he's probably his own man now, but, you know, they're just, they're imitative. They're not direct. And I'm not saying that you have to be Paul Butterfield or Steve Miller and do a residency with the real deal, because there's no real deal left. You are the real deal now. You know, you might find a handful of players in Holly Springs or somewhere like that in Mississippi or even in Houston. And there are some real players, but basically it's whoever's out there. The real deal now is Jimmy Vaughn. You know, that's, you know, the real deal is Lou Ann Barton, who started out at the Bluebird Nightclub, who learned her chops through Robert Ely. You know, the real deal is getting to hang out with Mike Buck. Mike is an elder now. I was in the Fort Worth Library talking with a guy about a year and a half ago after doing an event. And I just happened to be, I guess, loud enough that something about this guy came up to me and said, "Did you say Mike Buck's name?" And I said, "Yeah, maybe." And he said, "Is Mike Buck here?" And I said, "No." I said, "Do you know him?" He said, "No." And I said, and I kind of looked at him, he said, "But he's famous." So, you know, it's these young guys. Freddie Cisneros fixes Martin guitars and rare guitars in Prescott, Arizona. Lives a very genteel life now. Jackie's still playing, I think, with Alan Haynes now. And Jackie's been out there playing from the get-go. So it's like, you know, these aren't just imitative guys. But why white guys? It's because they didn't get the opportunity to be there and learn from a master and get that direct experience. It's their interpretation of what they think it is. And usually they overdo it for that reason.
Well, you know, you mentioned both Stevie Ray and Jimmy Vaughn. Were they part of this scene? Did they learn blues through direct transmission?
Partially. And that's kind of the interesting part. In Dallas, I know Jimmy would go out, you go hear Jimmy Reed and you can really watch him. I mean, everybody did that. Stevie did a little bit of that, and Stevie had a band called Blackbird, which included a guy named Christian DePleek, who's a black guy. His dad was the first black employee at Neiman Marcus. So Christian was not a typical black guy, but he played the role well. And, he was actually in the lexicon of the day, a Blackbird was a band with a spade in it, but it didn't go much beyond that. And even when they moved down to Austin, they played with a lot of different bands, but the Storm was an all white band. Actually, they had a black drummer for a while. And Stevie played with the Nightcrawlers, which is pretty much an all white band. It wasn't until Antone's. And that to me is like where Antone would bring in people. Definitely the Thunderbirds and Stevie were both nurtured by Clifford. They were given open slots. They would get nights where they'd play, and he'd pay me even if no one came. But they had direct access. Like, it started with Luther Tucker, I think, was the first player to be held over. He's just like, he didn't leave after the band came to town. And he was around Antone's all week, and he was around OK Records next door all week. What's the deal? Well, Clifford just paid for it. I'm hanging around. And then Hubert Sumlin did that for a while. And this was like for weeks long. Alan Wolf's guitar player. I remember I hung out a lot with Big Walter Horton, the harmonica player. Clifford would just keep these people around, and those that he couldn't afford to keep around. But like Albert King took time when Stevie was there to greet the bus. And somehow talked his way and became one of the few kids that Albert didn't just look down on, but actually liked. They sat down and they would talk shop. That's the important stuff and Stevie could learn from Albert Collins. I don't think they learned as kids from the masters so much as, like, I know Jimmy's influence was the Nightcaps, which was the all-white blues band from Dallas. Actually, they had a black sax player. In the 50s, they were white boys that played the blues and the biggest thing in Dallas, period. Huge in Texas. So, it's like getting those opportunities of transmission. I would argue Jimmy wasn't that good of a blues player in 1975 when Antone's opened. Stevie was still coming of age too.
So what's happening with the blues now? It feels to me like, I know there was a huge blues scene here in Austin in the 70s, maybe 80s. And I don't see much evidence that there's a lot of blues around town anymore. Has it kind of faded?
It's a smaller core scene, basically maintained by the elders that are still playing. Jimmy Vaughn, Derek O'Brien, a younger player, Mike Flanagan, on the B3, has kind of kept it going and has put out product and is out there. But it's generally who's left to maintain it? And that's, again, it's these guys are the elders, and there is a scene. Instead of Antone's, you generally go hang out at Seaboys and watch someone.
Seaboys or Giddy Up. Giddy Up has blues sometimes.
Giddy Up's does, as does, I guess you could argue Sam's Town Point does too. But there's not a pure blues scene because there's not pure blues players anymore. There's very few that do it well and do it, I don't know, either you're slavish or you're just way over the top. No one does it with righteous exuberance.
I was really fascinated by the book. There were some parts in there that I thought were just rather kind of funny. I mean, like the thing about when Ely was a drummer and how he forgot his drumsticks and just grabbed some sticks off a tree. And the thing about the guy who was eating light bulbs.
Oh, well, that's, I kind of wish we would have expanded a little more on that. I ended up just working with what I had as far as good transcript, but Ajax, the light bulb eater, as much talked about, you know, and that's the whole thing. And I mean, Sumter kind of put it in context. He was a geek. And that's the thing, is what the band is the band, but there's a show and there's many stories going on. So like, if you became a Bluebird regular, it's like you're watching right next to the bandstand is the main door. Who's going to walk in that door? And are they going to be customers? Or are they going to be someone that we didn't know were part of the entertainment, or are going to try to entertain, or just hustle the crowd for some money real quick? Which is, that was Ajax's thing. He's like, he'd just go around and get money, you know, to go eat light bulbs, spit up some blood, and women would be screaming, leaving the place, and that was his shtick, and he would move on. And there were all kinds. Barefoot Miller was an incredible barefoot tap dancer, and he would show up as the world's oldest teenager and do his routine at the Bluebird. But he goes back to the 1940s and 50s, excuse me, goes back to the 1940s and 50s as a tap dancer in New Orleans. He was a street dancer. And my brother-in-law, Johnny Reno, took Barefoot down to New Orleans on a trip for a long weekend. And this is when Johnny's playing in Robert's band and Barefoot's showing up a lot. And he swears, he tells me the scene of being down in the quarter with Barefoot, and all of a sudden Barefoot yells out, "Henry," and Professor Longhair turns around and he says, I think his name, he was went as Kidney Bean. He called him by his dancing name, but Professor Longhair immediately recognized him. They were old friends. Henry Roland Bird was Professor Longhair's real name. So, you know, there's a guy that just walks in, just like, you know, the night T-Bone Walker shows up. You know, that's like, he wasn't the first like that. And that's where I tried to, you know, Chuck Berry Jr., all these people with names that, or B.B. King Jr., people just make up personas. But that's what I loved about the club at that level, is that's part of the show. And the mystery is you don't know who's coming from behind the curtain, and neither does anyone else. And so just every night was like a memorable.
One of the things I've noticed when I was working in clubs in San Francisco and Oakland for many years is the true, really great clubs were not just businesses. They were living organisms. They were, you know, the sum of their parts. It wasn't just who was playing. It was the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. So it's who's dancing. I didn't get to do a shout out to James the Jumper, who was a black older man who wore overalls and was noted for his leaping dancing style. And if you were a young white woman that came into the club, pretty soon, sooner or later, you were going to dance with James the Jumper. That was kind of your initiation into the club. Just one dance, that's all. But yeah, it's community. And I think someone pointed out that it was a different place before the evening started. It was, you know, people come in and do dominoes. It was a community center. And Mabel's, you know, with gambling going on all the time. I'm sure there's some gambling at the Bluebird, but not. Mabel's was a wide open scene. And that helped subsidize the operation of Mabel's, no doubt. Or was the front, the club was the front for the gambling that went on. But there's always shit like that. There's, you know, there's a three-card Monty guy will show up out of the blue, and he'll last a night or two before they run him off. There's just and it was the place you knew you could go and ply your wares or do your thing or sit in and sing a song. If you had a song to sing, you probably could get away with it if you're pretty persistent. And Robert would always accommodate. So that was kind of the great thing about what he did is I don't think it was like, I'm raising a generation, but he was literally raising a generation by tolerating the scene that went on around him and yet keeping it authentic enough. It never became, you know, he's the token black in this conglomeration. Never was like that.
Well, we're kind of running out of time here. Let us know, or let the listeners know, how they can get their hands on this book.
Well, they can get their hands on Robert Ely in his Five Careless Lovers, an oral history. It's told by Freddie Cisneros, Sumter Bruton, Mike Buck, and Jackie Newhouse. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it exclusively retail right now at Record Town in Fort Worth, or go to their website, Record Town TX, or Antone's Record Shop in Austin. Or you can try to find me, Joe Nick Potoski. I'm joenickp@yahoo.com. And you can go to PayPal and order up a book and ask me to inscribe it. I'll do that. I'm not hard to find, and this book isn't that hard to find, but I haven't hammered it down, and I won't. No hype. I'm just glad to get the book out and tell this story. On February 27th, mark your calendar. That's a Saturday, 10:30 in the morning. I'll be doing a Zoom panel at the Fort Worth Library. Public Library is going to host a Zoom panel with Mike Buck, Jackie Newhouse, and me. And it's part of Black History Month.
February 26th, is the day before that, is the date that the album comes out.
And that's right. The reissue of Robert Ely and his Five Careless Lovers live at the new Bluebird Nightclub will be reissued and available on that day, the 27th, supposedly, if they don't run out, at Record Town in Fort Worth. So we're going to do a nice last blowout, and I'm going to get these guys to tell some more stories because, it's larger than life, and you can laugh and smile now that we all survived. But at the time, it was kind of sketchy.
A few cuts from that album are available on YouTube right now.
Yeah, and I still continue to play the album. All the cuts are good, but the main thing is you got to listen to the intros and outros, because you don't know the blues, but if it's 5 o'clock in the morning and your car won't start, you know what the blues are all about. Robert Ely said so.
Well, I have to admit that I bought my copy of the book from Antone's Records, and that's so I could support two of my favorite music institutions, them and you.
Well, thank you, Scoop. And, I only broke down and went on Amazon a couple weeks ago, and they're not selling it for any cheaper than my good friends at Antone's and my good friends at Record Town are selling it for. And you know where the money's going. I'm that way, too. So this is money well spent. None of it's being shipped off to any publishers in strange places. It's staying where it belongs, right here in Texas.
Hey, I want to mention before we drop the lineup for that album. It's on bass, 4-string Jack. On drums, Barrel House Bucky. On guitar, S.O.B. Sammy and Sliding Sumter Bruton. On piano, Good Rockin' Ralph. And on vocals, Robert Ely.
That's it. I mean, these were all who these guys were. South of the Border, Sammy later became, when Freddie fronted his own band. It was another band he was playing with. It was a guy named T.V. Owens. He renamed him T.V. Owens, and the band was called The Fabulous Erections. And Sammy Says It's Fat was the on the poster. I was glad to get mention of the Fabulous Erections in this book, which was some kind of triumph. If I would have published it elsewhere, they might have edited it out.
Well, thanks much.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. And don't give up the blues, because we all still got them one way or another.
I got really fired up listening to that music this morning. It's just great. It just really is like, it's the right time of the year for it, too.
Yeah, John.
It is. I mean, I feel pent up, and I listen to it. It just makes me laugh. And you know, when I'm laughing till I'm crying, there's some value in that. That music from then can still do that. And it's good music. It gets on Boogie Chillin', which, you know, hey, oh, it's John Lee Hooker again. Well, in the 50s, Robert's duo was Boogie Chillin'. That was their name. And that song there, especially Ralph on organ, it's trance music. I mean, you know, The Doors, Light My Fire is nowhere as trance inducing as this version of Boogie Chillin'. I mean, it really does get you into this zone. And I like music that does that. So I wrote a review when it came out, and I was in Minneapolis, and I was just getting my head full of being a record. I wanted to write about music. I wanted to be a music critic. And I'm in Minneapolis. I'm at the Electric Fetus. That's my day job. But I do a review for Buddy Magazine, this giveaway magazine in Dallas. And it's one of their first issues. And I know the publisher editor, Stony Burns. And, you know, it's a music magazine, but it's really dumb. It's all press releases, basically. And in it, I review Robert E. Lee's album. And I said, all you readers have it all wrong. The rock music you're listening to is terrible. This is what you should be listening to. And I got a hate letter back. And this is from a free giveaway publication. I got a hate letter. So I knew I was on the path. And they sent me on the path. This, you know, again, I owe so much of my being and my twisted philosophy to watching Robert and the boys do their magic and not getting killed.
You're not famous until you get hate mail.
No, well, you know, I'm used to it now. I'm good with it.
All right. I hope you can visit us again soon.
Anytime. Just holler. I hope I have a reason to talk about something somewhere down the line. But
there's always something to talk about.
Well, I guess so. And again, this is my COVIDian project. I'm now officially ready for the pandemic to be over. Let's call it a plague. And let's get back to the way things used to be or something, some semblance thereof.
You can follow Joe Nick Petoskey at joenickp.com. You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.